Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, I interview Richard J. Alexander about the grand opening of the new Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts in Orlando, Florida. Afterwards, Peter Felicia and Michael Potentiere join in to review The Last Ship at the Neil Simon, Godlike Theater Company's production of Deliverance at 59 East 59, and Can Can at the Paper Mill Playhouse. Please stay tuned.
Echoes the beating of the drums. There is a life about to start when tomorrow comes. Will you join in our crusade? Who will be strong and stand with me? Beyond the barricade, is there a world you long to see?
Then join in the fight that will give you the right to be free.
And welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for the week of November 10th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and the broadcast this morning are Peter Felicia and Michael Portantiere. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Stripper, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI Kritzerland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Michael Portantiere is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Just a note for our listeners, we've changed the release schedule of Broadway Radio to be Friday and Saturday instead of our Sunday morning release to see if this works out better for you. If you have questions or comments or want to weigh in, just drop us an email. All the contact information is at BroadwayRadio.com. With us this evening, we have a very special guest. Richard J. Alexander is joining us by phone, and he is coming up on a new venture. He's launching. Well, Richard J., why don't you tell us about the new venture that that you are helping to launch now?
Well, it's pretty exciting. It's the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts in Orlando, which is a new performing arts center, which consists of three things on the property. One is the theater we're going to open on Saturday night, November 15th. That's the Walt Disney Theater. There's also a beautiful 300-seat theater inside the structure, and they're going to finish up the concert hall, which I think is going to be about 1,700 or 1,500 seats. So that's the last building that's going to be done. But this has been like 11 years in the making. And all the Broadway touring shows will be playing there now. I used to play the Bob Carr Center for the Performing Arts.
Sure.
And, you know, it's everybody thinks of Orlando. They think of Disney. You know, they think of Disney World and Universal and stuff like that. And this is a real arts center. So I'll tell you the God's truth is the day we buried my dad passed away recently, and my phone was vibrating in my pocket. And so it was about coming down to interview for this. And I really sort of didn't care to work. You know, I just really didn't. But I went down and I got a tour by Catherine Ramsberger, who's, you know, this has been, you know, she has led this project through everything. And there I was in a hard hat with her, and I was looking at how passionate and how much she knows about design and all this. And I'll tell you something, James, I've been all over the world, and I've got a 40-year career behind me, and I've never seen a building like this. It reminded me very much of the new Perez Art Museum down here in Miami in terms of its airiness and architecture. And a lot of these buildings are a lot of concrete and stuff, and the theater is stunning. It's truly, truly stunning. So at the end of the day, I gave her a hug, and I was being taken back to the airport, and I said, wow, I feel like it's a privilege. And that's not phone talk or trying to be a good interviewer or anything like that. I really felt it. And I've opened a lot of theaters, do you know what I mean, whether it was the Broward Performing Arts, which they built for Phantom, or the Princess of Wales for Miss Saigon, you know, back when I was working for Cameron or whatever. And this is going to be something. But the show itself is going to be I don't know, like I leave tomorrow morning for Orlando, and it's going to be sort of a party. I know everybody who's performing, whether it's Michael Urie, whether it's Deborah Voigt, whether it's Jane Monheit, the Lombard twins, Norm Lewis is getting the night off from the Majestic on Broadway to come because he's from Orlando. Walt Strung, who I just met this summer in Provincetown, this kid I found on YouTube, Jeremy Green. It's going to be like an amazing, amazing night. And the idea is it's arts for everyone. And so I also have Hector Rivera, who J-Lo introduced to the 50 million people. He's Puerto Rican, and there's an enormous Puerto Rican population base there in Orlando, and I'm Latin. And so we're doing La Última Noche, and I don't know, we're going to slam this night. And so I'm pretty excited. It's a great lineup by New York standards. Do you know what I'm saying? So
sure.
I think Orlando is going to be pretty excited, and it's going to be a party, and there's fireworks after, and of course it's got Walt Disney's name on it, and so we're nodding, you know, our head to that. I've got Sierra Boggess, who was in The Little Mermaid on Broadway, and also, you know, with Norm, and just finished doing Phantom with him. So it's going to be, musically, it's going to be wild. There's a 26-piece orchestra conducted by Mary Mitchell Campbell from Broadway, and we've been rehearsing. I just got back from New York. They're rehearsing in New York now. We're rehearsing all over the world in different places, and everybody's, all destination points this weekend are to Orlando. So I'm excited. I'm nervous. I'm excited. I'm nervous. I'm scared. I'm excited. I'm nervous.
So Mary Mitchell Campbell is possibly the only person as busy as you are, you know, to get to the two.
She's busier than I am. Mary Mitchell Campbell is
isn't
the busiest
she awesome?
Girl alive. Try and get her on the phone. It's about texting, and I feel like a teenager. But I'll tell you, I met her working with Kristen Chenoweth. That was the first time she and I ever worked together, when I started working with Kristen 2 years ago. And I love her so much. You know, I have my favorites. I love Kevin Stites. I love, there's a lot of people I love, you know, but Mary Mitch, everybody comes with their own set of unique gifts, you know, but her ear is remarkable. And I love creating with her. It's wonderful when, ego is not the right word, but yeah, I guess it is. Like when nobody's territorial about anything, or working with Matt Berman, who does my lights and sound, like as far as I'm concerned, he's a director too. And so is Mary Mitchell. Like, tell me what you think. Tell me what you hear. Tell me. I love the sparring. Do you know what I mean? I think that's maybe why Barbara and I get along so well.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara being Barbara Streisand, of course, for your listeners. I don't know, like a lot of people say they love rehearsal, but they're lying. Like, they don't. They want results. And I actually love to rehearse, you know what I mean? Not
sure.
Forever.
Yeah.
But when you rehearse with talented people, like today Deborah Voigt was working in New York, you know, with Kevin Stites and learning a couple of songs, it's going to be very exciting, because you're going to be the first person to know this, but, you know, Deborah Voigt is the greatest dramatic soprano in the world. And I met her working with her at Carnegie Hall with Kristen, and we had a lot of fun, and we just fell in love with each other. And so, you know, she's going to do two pieces she's never done before. One is from Sunset Boulevard. She's going to do With One Look, because that's about as big an operatic as you can get.
Sure.
With that huge Andrew Lloyd Webber score and just the drama of it. And she can certainly fill that. And then she's going to sing I Love You Porgy with Norm, which is going to be thrilling, because Norm, of course, was nominated for Tony. But I come from a Porgy and Bess background. I worked on the 1977 revival with Klamydale and Donny Ray Albert that won the Tony.
Oh, my goodness.
And so to put those two voices together, it's going to be thrills and spills. And so for me, I don't know, what I love to do is I love honoring the assignment. So I don't like to hire people or ask people to come and do park and bark, where they just come and do what they do.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And it's
sure.
kind of everything's being created for this night. We got the Broadway kids, you know, we've got a special overture, you know, with video content. We got a lot of shout outs. It's going to be exciting. It's certainly not put together yet.
Well,
you know,
tell
with
me.
The tip of the hat to Stephen Sondheim putting it together, but the pieces are there, and now it's going to be assembled. And it's great because everybody's working really hard. Working with Michael Urie in a closed room is a joy to behold. With him and Mary Mitchell on a piano, it's like the possibilities are endless. So I'm sort of nuts. I still love what I do, and I'm not jaded. I certainly have opinions, and I've been around. But I still love actors and actors who sing, and I love talent, and it turns me on. And I don't know, it's like, give me Play-Doh, and I'll make I'll build something.
So I'm looking at, you know, the last couple of years of your schedule involving big concerts with Barbra Streisand, Bernadette Peters, Brian Stokes Mitchell, Kristen Chenoweth, Bette Midler.
Wow, where's that chart?
You know, how do you get from Richard J. Alexander, the young child, to Richard J. Alexander, who is a worldwide director? How did that happen?
Well, it's a pretty good question, and I think the answer is not going to be too surprising. I'll start with, you know, when people go, do you have any suggestions for my kid or my granddaughter or mm-hmm. my grandson who want to get in the business. Barbara and I agree on this. If you have to ask, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. There is no formula, and especially these days with YouTube and all that. But I went to see a production of Bye Bye Birdie in a high school auditorium when I was 10 years old. And my dad, it was a church production, full orchestra, high school aged kids. He was helping count the tickets, his CPA and all that. And and I saw the telephone hour and I was done. I was just done. You know, the two hairs I had on my arm at 10 years old stood up. And, you know, and I started going to the library and learning cast albums. And my dad saw my passion because everybody else is doctors and lawyers and CPAs and electricians. And, you know, everybody did good. And I was the showbiz crazy. But my dad started buying me the New York Times on Sundays, and, you know, I would pour over that Arts and Leisure. Look, Mom, the Andrews Sisters heard a musical called Over Here. I was nuts, and the library would call me when a new album showed up, and that's how I learned all my words and lyrics and shows, and then I was venturing downtown, you know, where it was dangerous to go on the bus and see shows, and the inner city of Syracuse, and the Me Nobody Knows, and, you know, and I started doing community theater and those high school shows and all that, and then I had terrible grades. Like, I failed algebra 3 times, and the teacher would say, you know, Richard, you're not applying yourself. I go, what does this have to do with show business?
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't even know what the hell you're talking about. And, you're being ridiculous. And I would go home and tell my dad. She thinks I'm ridiculous. Well, that's all my dad needed to hear as an educator himself. So I had a lot of support, you know, because my dad knew it was important to be passionate about something. So I started doing summer stock and got my equity card, and I had terrible grades. I got turned down by every college in America. And then I grew up in Syracuse, so my dad invited the chairman of business administration, the chairman of theater and music. My dad was the chairman of business administration at a neighboring college at Lemoyne to come see me in my senior show. I played Joe Hardy and Damn Yankees. I shudder to even think. But anyway, and they made albums and everything. And they took me, I think, on enthusiasm for a semester. Well, of course, once you start studying what you love, you know, and you take music and piano lessons and learn how to read music. And I was nuts. And I got out of school in 3 years and moved to San Francisco and went to ACP and sold kids' shoes at Macy's. And I got the revival of the voice from Syracuse on the West Coast. Then I got scouted in a musical with Divine called The Heartbreak of Psoriasis. And I worked in box offices of things like Piaseka Cat Is Dead and Evolution of the Blues, John Hendricks. And I saved $2,000 and I moved to New York. And I got my first off-Broadway show the first week I was in town. And the rest is sort of history. You know, I did a lot of jobs. I worked at Tiffany as holiday help. I worked at Brentano's bookstore. I went to class. I was a waiter. But I always was in class. I didn't go to Fire Island. I didn't do any of the play things that everybody else was doing. And they were meeting people more quickly than I was. But I really applied myself. And then I got my first Broadway show, Zoot Suit, at the Winter Garden, where, interestingly, Barbara did Funny Girl, and I saw my first Broadway show on Broadway, MAME. Huh. And, you know, I was a performer, and I was in Saturday Night Fever and a lot of films and television and soap operas and things like that. And the name change, because I was born Richard Alexander Fernandez, came because there was a Richard Fernandez, and I did the national tour of the Me Nobody Knows. And so I started out as Richard Alexander, and then when I did my first film, there was a Richard Alexander who was a SAG member in the old Flash Gordon series that mm-hmm. was still working regionally, so that's where the J got invented from. So then when Richard Alexander died, they said, do you want your name? I said, no, I'm in too far deep now. So anyway, so, and then, you know, I was in Amadeus, and, you know, I had a friend who said, you should try to direct the tours, and I went to the Schuberts, and, you know, I said, do you think that Peter Hall and Peter Sheffer and the National Theatre of Great Britain and William Morris would ever approve me? And they did, and that was sort of the beginning of the change, and meeting the Trevor Nunns and John Cairds and Cameron McIntosh, and I stage managed, I was a dance captain. My story wasn't so different from Cameron's in England, where he did every job in theatre. And, you know, when you see a show when you're young, you only see actors. You don't know from lighting design, from stage management, from anything. Like, how do they do that? It's more of a show-off thing. And I wanted to be that. And then you start looking at the skill sets. And, you know, I could crunch numbers. And because my dad gave us checkbooks when we were 10 years old because he was a CPA. And that's how we got our allowance. And one thing led to another. And, you know, the rest happened. Of course, the biggest thing that happened was when Cameron told me about Les Miserables. And I was going to Santiago, Chile to direct the Spanish premiere for the Teatro Nacional de Santiago in Chile. And I bought the book at Coliseum Books of Les Miserables. And I saw how fat it was. And I'm like, are you kidding? Nobody wants a job that bad. And I started to read it. And I'm not a particularly quick reader. And I was enthralled. And I called Cameron. I said, who's going to direct this? And he said, Trevor and John. And I said, can you get me an interview? And I flew over, and I think they sort of patted me on the head and said, you know, what a nice boy, musical. But then I went, and, you know, when the show opened, and I don't know, after Red and Black, I was sitting next to, who was in the summer of 42? Jekyll and Bissett. Mm. And we were both whisked off at intermission, you know, to one of those little private drinking rooms. And I couldn't breathe. I, like, remember I couldn't breathe, and I thought, this is going to change the world. And I had a meeting with Trevor and John, and I told them what I thought was wrong with the show, which was pretty cocky at 30, whatever years old I was. But they listened. Like I said, Stars is in the wrong place. The show's not even that girl singing the stupid song, I Saw Him Once, and we saw it happen. Like, let's get on with it, you know? And the, you know, and the rest is history, and a pretty happy history. And then, you know, I worked with Bernadette on Song and Dance, and then she asked me to do the Carnegie Hall concert, and that's when the concert work came tumbling in, because, you know, it was a very interesting time. It was in the 90s, and Bernadette didn't want to visit, you know, Dames at Sea or Mac and Mabel or any of that. And I said, then you've got the wrong guy, because, of course, part of my story is I'm a fan of everybody I've worked with. So I feel like I'm a good audience member. It's not a formula, but I think it's a good starting point, because you can't gauge where somebody fell in love with you. Do you know what I mean? I remember listening to Dames at Sea, and that voice was so distinctive, going, who the hell is that? Or Time Heals Everything. Or, and so we did it. And, you know, she came up with the idea of doing the whole second half Sondheim. And we scored big with that show. Big, big, big. And it was risky. And the New York Times wanted to come, and it was a benefit for the gay men's health crisis. And the New York Times wanted to come, and they, I wanted to make an album. And she sort of said yes to all of that. And then we got the Grammy nomination. And, you know, then people like Polly Bergen, you know, at 70, came back into the business. And I did that show. And Stokes, Brian Stokes Mitchell, and, you know, and it, I started getting these offers. And then, you know, one day my phone rings. I'm walking around Miami on Lincoln Road, and Miss Richard J., yeah, it's Bette Midler. I'm like, who is this? It's Bette Midler. No, who is this really? It's Bette Midler. Will you talk to me, you know, on a break from, you know, Stanford Wine? And, you know, I'm like, okay, seriously? Or when I was in Provincetown, I was there with my lawyer, Mark Sendroff, with Bob Mackey and Robert Richards and Richie Ridge and, you know, all my pals. And I get a phone call from Marty Ehrlichman and go, you know, do you have time to work with Barbara? And I remember literally, I mean, he couldn't see me. And this was a hotel phone. There were no cell phones yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm at the Brass Key or somewhere like that. I don't know. And I look at my watch and I go, oh, I think so. I have time, you know. And I go to dinner that night. And, of course, you know, you sound like an idiot. I'm going to work with Barbara Streisand. But, you know, it's been 14 years now. And so, you know, I know my stuff. And no two stars are alike, but I love my work, and I love the process. I really do love it, and I don't just pick things and you don't do it. Other people go crazy if you do this. Like, that's not me. Like, we think, and we talk, and we address, and we try, and, you know, and I don't know. I love it. Even starting with Kristen, you know, we did a show and tell for each other. You know, she'll say, the people love this. And I go, yeah, they did for 15 years. You know, can we move on? You know, Taylor the Latte Boy, really? You know, you're 45 years old. Thank you for the extra foam. It's those kinds of discussions. And I don't, they're not demeaning. They're like, you know, okay, like, we can do that. You know what I mean? It works. Or are we going to push the envelope and go further? Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure, absolutely.
Or the reason to do a maybe this time, or one less bell. Not because of Glee, because we do the full real versions of the song. You know, we honor the writers, we honor the Candor and Ebb, or the fact that they wrote the first Broadway show that was in. What I learned from Bernadette is truth. I know I'm in show business. Do you know what I mean? But I don't like trickery or phoniness or bad dialogue. Do you know what I mean? Like, how many shows have we all seen where it's like, this is one of my favorite songs, ladies and gentlemen. I hope it's one of yours too. Really? I will throw something at you. Like, I really will. Okay? Cut the shit. Okay? So I come from a very interesting point of view. And I'm a handful. You know, I'm challenging. But, you know, you don't fight with people, but you have healthy discussions, and they're fun to have because you will get there, but you do it together. You know, and that lyric that Stephen Sondheim always says, you know, don't leave me halfway through the wood. You know, let's stick together. We did this together. Don't bail, because everybody does have their security things or the things they know works. And going into uncharted territory is dangerous, but it turns me on. You know what I mean? and I'm there. And, you know, why would I go down? And I'm there for whoever I'm working with. And whether you're doing a book musical or you're working at the Hollywood Bowl or whether you're at the Opera House or Carnegie Hall or, you know, whatever, I welcome it. And I think I've played almost everywhere in the world now with some kind of artist or another at every cabaret. And I don't know, I still get turned on. I really do. There's that thing about not knowing, is it going to work? Do you know what I mean? Will they laugh at that line? Do you know what I'm saying? And also, by the way, all material should come from the performer. It's not like you write dialogue. Like when I hear See That an Act is written by somebody, I get really nervous because then it doesn't look like it's coming from them. So part of it is wanting that credit, which I've never wanted. But the other thing is the story is theirs. So what you do is you adapt it and you give it cadence. You know, Bernadette talks different than Barbara, who talks different than Bette, who has a rat-a-tat style. Or, you know, no two people are the same, but you have to speak in their language, not your language, meaning mine. And so that's part of the creation and the story. Like, working with Norm Lewis was such a revelation, do you know what I mean, his blackness. And it just came out. It wasn't planned. And he would tell me a story about after 9/11, how his sister called him from Atlanta and said, everybody's playing What's Going On every radio station nonstop. You know, and so we looked at that song. Do you know what I mean? But I said, you know, everybody knows it as a Motown hit. But I said, if you don't cock a hip or beat a thing or snap a finger and you do Marvin Gaye's poetry and let the band slam... And we did it. And it just, you know, don't punish me with brutality, you know, picket signs and picket lines. And, you know, we just honored those words, right, while the band slammed. And he just delivered it. And he got a standing ovation. And I swear, you sit there and you cry. You know what I mean? Because it's a risk. You know, the Black National Anthem. You know, what is that, Norm? Teach me. It's pretty fantastic, you know. Or even working with Ricky Martin, you know, the first time. You know, and being Puerto Ricano, and my background is Cuban and Spanish, which is different from Mexican, which is different from Dominican. There's so much to learn. You know what I mean? Like, so much. I'm working with the Lombard twins in this show, you know, from Argentina. It's just, I don't know, like, my life's pretty effing exciting. I'm a perennial student, and I still get turned on, and I still, I don't know, maybe because I'm older now, my heart is on my sleeve even more because I don't need or want anything from anybody. But truth, you can't beat it. Because if you do a truthful show or a truthful act, you're beyond criticism. Do you know what I'm saying? And then if criticism comes, it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Because the truth is there. But, you know, the track record and the batting average have been pretty good. And I just keep following, you know, my beliefs. And also, if... You know, it doesn't mean you have to work with everybody, but when you do have that talk, and there are people that I've talked to that don't want to be who they are, and they want to sing New York, New York, well, you know, I pass, you know what I mean? Because that doesn't interest me, you know what I mean?
Tell me about, tell me about, you know, it's so inspiring what you said here, but if this didn't come together the way it has come together for you over the last 30 years, what else would you be doing with your life? Do you have any?
Nothing.
Nothing? Nothing. This is it.
No, it's like, you know, that's a great question. It's sort of like Barbara's mom used to say, you know, secretary, like, wow, you know, with these nails. Or, you know, some people don't have an option. And she and I are on exactly the same page about that. My dad, you know, who was an educator, would say, you know, Dick, I want you to have something to fall back. And I'm like, yeah, Dad, like what? Like, I'm either going into theater or I'm going to be a CPA. Like, it's not going to happen that way. And I was an unstoppable train. And, you know, it's so interesting to be having this conversation with you right now. And that's a great question. Because, like, this Wednesday, Playbill is doing their favorite things, you know, where you pick shows that influenced you. And, of course, the year I moved to New York was the fall of 1975. So the trifecta, you know, for me, and I was broke, I'm telling you. I would buy $6 standing room seats, you know, and I saw Chicago. You know, and I saw Gwen Verdon come up out of the pit with the gin flask sitting on the piano, and I thought I was going to have a heart attack. I really did. Like, you know, Gwen Verdon, after listening to her for years in a library, you know, in Sweet Charity and all that. Like, I couldn't even afford the albums. Then I saw Chorus Line from the last seat on the left in the last balcony, but I didn't give a shit because, you know, I knew I was watching something that would never happen again in history, and that was thrilling. And, you know, who could imagine you'd know Donna McKechnie in the future, or that you would talk to Gwen Verdon, or know Cheetah, or these things are not even possible when you move to New York. But the biggest one, the transformative one, was watching The Wiz from standing room for $6 on a rainy Friday night, my first Friday in New York. And I really didn't know where my next meal was coming from, but I sure wasn't going to go home. And she sang Home. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, God, if I don't work here, I don't know what I'll do with my life. You can't even imagine. And so, you know, when I would say seeing something in the park with George, who could know that I was going to work with Bernadette Peters? Who could know I'd be talking to Angela Lansbury and working with Bea Arthur? And it's just, it's not, something's not right. You know what I mean? It's like you're talking to somebody who all his dreams have come true and more. And I continue to find myself in the most wildly unbelievable situations, or sitting across from Diana Ross, you know, being interviewed. Like, really? Really? Lady Sings the Blues, you know, at my local cinema? I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, we're talking to Liza, or it's just, you know, how did this happen? Like, how did it happen? And there's no formula or anything like that. And so, no, I don't give advice. And I'm done singing people's children and grandchildren. You know what I mean? They're so talented. No, they're not. Okay? And I'm not going to be the one to tell you anymore. Because it's not, you know, I'd rather be your friend.
Sure.
You know, would you just listen once? No. Would you listen to his demo? No. You know, it's a recipe for murder.
Oh my goodness! So you split your time between, you know, New York and Miami and the rest of the world.
Well, that's an interesting question. Also, wow, you're so good. This is fun. For almost 40 years, I was a New Yorker, and I took a place in LA about, I guess, 20 years ago. No, 14 years ago. And so I had three places. I bought this house in Miami 22 years ago. So I'm living here full time. I gave up New York and LA. It was getting to be a lot of property.
Sure.
And you know, when you travel, so for example, when you're doing your taxes and you're looking at how many days were you anywhere, you were more days away from any of your homes than, you know, so if you go on tour with somebody or this or that, or you're rehearsing in another city or you're prepping here or you get a movie or, you know, you're shooting a commercial, whatever. And I was sort of nowhere. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to try to condense the three homes, move to Miami because, you know, I'm Cuban and the whole thing works for me and I'm bilingual, and see how it goes. And so this Christmas, it'll be 3 years. And my housekeeper of 26 years moved to Orlando. So, and we both have dogs that were adopted together and stuff like that. So, you know, she's going to come to the opening and the dogs are together right now hanging out. And so it's all worked out. You know what I mean? And, but, you know, I was just in New York. And, you know, once you're a New Yorker, you're always a New Yorker. So the only thing that's changed about my life is my theater going has condensed. Rather than seeing things in real time, I see things in groups. Like, I'll go in for 5 days and see five shows. Or,
sure.
You know, stuff like that. But the more interesting part, this is the most interesting, like, somebody you'll consider a good friend in New York, you'll see maybe once a year or maybe twice. Now I go in and I'm targeted. You know what I'm saying? And I have a schedule, and you actually see people because you're making a schedule rather than like, oh, yeah, if I'm going to watch Housewives, I'd rather sit my ass down here on the couch, you know, and watch it here and go to the beach in the daytime, you know, rather than sitting in cold New York watching Housewives of Atlanta.
You know, one of the things, you know, you're the ultimate insider and outsider for Broadway all at the same time. And I know this because everybody in the industry, you just don't do the high profile, I'm going to go to the XYZ event that's really large. I mean, I saw wedding photos from Rob Diamond over at Broadway World. You and Rob Diamond are you know, could have been the two girls in Sideshow, you know?
Well, we've turned out to be best friends. I met him when I was doing, I was asked to do a benefit for Broadway World to benefit Broadway Cares, which I'm on the board of, of Andrea McCardle. And of course, you know, she had done Les Mis with me and I did her TV special for PBS. So that's where we first met. And I think Rob didn't like me too much. I think if you talk to him, you know, and I would call his website a high school website and stuff like that. And over the, you know, cause I didn't know anybody on it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, everybody's so young, I guess. But anyway, we've become we're very best friends, and his wife, Jen. And, but, you know, listen, I'll go to a little theater with a trash can on fire, you know, to keep the garage warm if it interests me. But I am very eclectic, just like my Facebook posting. Like, I'm a Facebook whore. And, you know, people, I'm not on it that much, but, you know, I've always got my phone or something with me and I see something that interests me. And my taste is very, very eclectic. So, yes, I can do, you know, I do know my Shakespeare, my Ibsen, my Shaw. I am educated. But, yeah, I'll sit down with the housewives, you know. Or if I go out one night with Kristen and Reza and we go to, you know, the place where Vanderpump Rules is. What's the name of that restaurant? That she owns. Anyway, and I'm like having a reality night from hell, which is utterly fantastic. So, you know, and also just the opportunities I've been given and, you know, the travel and seeing the world, you know, working. And as early as 1977, when I got to go to Paris with Porgy and Bess, you know, with Sherwin Goldman and the Houston Grand Opera production, you know, I've been really, really lucky. And when you think about how people don't get to travel or whatever, but I love. What does that mean, insider and outsider? What does that mean when you said that?
When I said that, I meant that it's not that you just hang out with, you know, the Barbara Streisands of the world. That everybody in the industry, from the ushers to the IA guys to front of house to the actors to the
Bill
pit,
Berlone,
to
the dog trainer, to
you're everywhere. Those are your peeps.
And they're closing the Edison Cafe, and some people are going, oh, you know, filthy. And I'm like, you know, F you, you know. Like, I lived there for 12 years of my life with Cameron McIntosh up at 226 West 47th, and she kept me healthy with the chicken soup,
sure.
You know what I mean, and the bagels and stuff. So everybody's got their story and their history, but, you know, Broadway's changed like 4 times since I've been in New York, like in waves and stuff. And I came in at the sort of tail end of the what I call the real Broadway, do you know what I mean, when it was, you know, when cast albums were essential. You know, like if you go to the Salvation Armies down here in Miami, you know, you see a million copies of Man of La Mancha, a million copies of Fiddler on the Roof, a million copies of Carousel and Sound of Music. And no modern musicals really represent that. Do you know what I mean? I don't know whose albums or CDs will be there, you know, when we're all gone.
Yeah.
You know, or digital downloads or whatever. But, you know, I still have a cassette player. I still have a 78 player for my old, you know, records from Cuba from my parents. I've got, you know, a turntable. I've got like everything in every format because, like, for example, the weekend that Mary Mitchell and Kristen came down and Dames was born in this house, the Dames of Broadway, all of them, where the conundrum was, am I the leading lady or am I the sidekick? And we were listening in all mediums. And when we heard Flora the Red Menace and heard the intro to Quiet Thing, none of us had ever heard it. And I'm playing it on vinyl. And, I don't know. It's just interesting. And so I'm into hard goods. I'm not into digital downloads. I love liner notes. I love all of that. I've written a lot of liner notes, actually, as you probably know.
Yes.
And I love that, you know. And I don't know. Information is great. You can't trust everything you read on Google. I don't know. Listen, you listeners, I'm telling you that. You can't just believe something because it's there or it's in Wikipedia that it's true. And also you have to sense that if it's not sounding right or feeling right, you know, look it up a little further. Do you know what I'm saying? And you'll find, you know, conflicting reports, and then you have to find out. Interestingly, when I did the liner notes for Jacques Brel's Alive and Well Living in Paris, the re-release, you know, that's the name of the show, right? But he wasn't alive and well. He had throat cancer, and it was a big secret. And this was big news when I dropped that bomb in the reissue, you know, and I found out from the producer who was still living in the Village in New York City, and you know, I went down to talk to him on the phone, and went to meet him and Ellie Stone. And, you know, this kind of stuff excites me. Do you know what I mean? Or when I saw Pearly when I was in high school with my brother, you know, who knew I'd be working with Melba Moore? I mean, my story's sort of ridiculous and sort of fantastic, you know, but it's, I don't know, in a weird way, it sort of all makes sense also. But I didn't really chase anything. It sort of happened. And I'm sort of proud of that part of it. But if you saw my childhood bedroom still, it's there. You know, there's a whole Barbara wall, and there's pictures of Liza and Bernadette and, you know, Lauren Bacall on the cover of Life and Applause. And I was nuts. So if there was a Broadway World or a Playbill Online or, you know, any of these websites when I was 10 years old, I'd be crazier than I am.
So let's get back and wrap up your the show that is coming up is the opening of the Dr. Phillips Center. And for those uninitiated in the ways of Florida, Dr. Phillips is a person who was a Florida citrus magnate and has become a big section of the Orlando area.
Wow, you've really done your research. I'm impressed. Are you coming to this, by the way?
I cannot make it. I am not make it, but my wife has a Disney problem. So we go to Disney very often. So I'm sure that at one point or another in the next 6 months, we will be there.
Yeah, you have to meet Catherine. She's quite an inspiration. But, you know, I'm taking myself there, right? And I'm just listening mm-hmm. to, you know, we're opening. The overture is a instrumental version of Putting It Together.
Okay.
And it's very exciting. And Mary Mitchell sent it out to have it orchestrated. And I heard it the other night for the first time. And I just started crying, you know, because I've never heard it so big and full with all those instruments, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, you know, it's going to be accompanied by a piece of film. But just to go into this hall and crackle it open and with all these people and everybody's coming for the right reasons. Nobody's coming for the money or the stardom. Everybody's coming, you know, because they're going to come back here and play in the future. And it's just, I got really lucky, you know, with availability. Some people had to be somewhere the next day, this, that. But I cracked open my phone book and I just started calling people. And then all of a sudden the musical program fell in. But for the audience, it's going to be very exciting. And afterwards, I guess there's a big party and fireworks and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know, we're all going to take Sunday off and hang out by the pool and drink Bloody Marys in our robes. And hopefully the weather will be great. But
we'll take pictures.
Deborah
and
Voigt, come on, Deborah Voigt.
Yeah.
You know? Singing from Sunset Boulevard. I'm sorry. Like, that's worth the price of admission alone, you know?
Well, I can't think of anybody better suited to open it up, Richard J. I'm so excited about it.
My name came up. I mean, I think I heard that a few people brought it up. And also, by the way, it was very late, close to the date, because they didn't know if the building would be ready.
Mm-hmm.
So I had wondered if they asked a few people before me and had been turned down. You know what I mean? But I found out that was the original ask. So, you know, lucky me. And this is my last job of the year. I'm going to take, you know, the rest of the year off and sort of mourn the loss of both my parents, which I lost over 10 months. But
oh, I'm sorry,
you know, I'm lucky because they were with me for so long and no Alzheimer's, no illness, no nothing. So I'm blessed, but they're still gone. And so our family dynamic, you know, this will be the first big holiday. And so I'm just going to sort of soak it up and not work, you know, because work's a nice distraction. But then, you know how it is.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Like postpartum depression, you know, 16 times a year when you finish something. And the things I do don't run long. You know, they're shorter things or concerts or a tour gets launched or. But you know, it's exciting. I'm so happy you're interested. Wow, you really did your research. I'm really impressed. I'm gonna lunch on that insider outsider thing.
Well, the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts is opening up with a star-studded gala concert on Saturday, November 15th, which is coming up in just a few days. So,
And by the way, anybody who's listening to this, if you do happen to go, please, like, let me know you heard this and come say hello and let me know. And then I can tell James, you know, how exciting that is, because it does make a difference. And there are very few platforms for people like us, you know, whether it's PBS or whatever. These are the people that look after our work and what we do and interest and, you know, have you as a core audience. So please tap me on the shoulder and say hello. Oh, wait, we have one more story before
we
go.
Do
we have time?
Sure.
It's so interesting that I remember people would walk in the room, right, or they'd dress like the album, and I'd go, oh, brother. But then sometimes people would come in, and they'd be perfect looking for a part, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, that's Angeros, you know what I mean? Just the way Victor Hugo mm-hmm. described him, an angel of death, blonde, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they'd walk in the room, and I would literally go like this, oh, my God, I hope you can sing. And they would look terrorized and go, yeah, me too. Because, you know, like, you got to the point where you used up the talent pool that was available, so now you were nurturing people.
Sure.
And listen, I went everywhere. I went to Nashville. I went to Branson. I went to Disney World. I found people everywhere and had the move because we had like 11 companies. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
but it got to be a training ground, and I'm very proud of the track record. I mean, look at Lea Michele. I found her when she was 8 years old.
You look at the Kim training schools in the Philippines for Saigon. You know,
they were
literally growing them.
Well, that was the thing. And I guess they got to start growing them again now. I hear it's coming back.
I hear that.
It's really strange when shows you were a part of, like when Amadeus came back, you know, in its first revival. And I said to Amy Irving, because we were in it together, and she replaced Jane Seymour. And I said, God, Amy, when shows are in revival in your own lifetime, isn't it time to get out, you know? And now, you know, Les Mis won't die, and Saigon's coming back, and I'm just like, oh, my God, you know, what year is this? I'm so confused.
Well, Richard J., thank you so much for spending so much
Thanks
time with us.
Thanks for taking the time. This is really nice of you.
All right, we'll speak to you soon.
All right, take
Thanks.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
When we are parted, one day more, tomorrow you'll be worlds away, and yet with you my world has started.
No car chases and no blown up buildings in The Last Ship. The three of us got a chance to see that over at the Neil Simon Theater. Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, one thing I have to say for Sting is that he did his homework by getting a rhyming dictionary. Of all the pop songwriters, this is the one that had perfect rhymes more than any other. And I'm sure people are already sick of me bringing this up so quickly, because I always do. But it really was a revelation to hear words rhyme most of the time, a great majority of the time. At least at the very worst, you give them an A-. But that's pretty much higher than we usually get. So great. So far, so good. Music's quite fine. Very evocative. Sounds like the era we're in and the place we're in, which is in northern England in a small town. And shipbuilding's the industry there, but it's not going to be anymore. And that's the real problem here, because these men have been building ships all their lives, and suddenly that's being taken away from them. The story also involves a guy who named Gideon, who grew up in the town and was not going to settle for being a shipbuilder. He was going to go away and seek his fortune. Now it's 15 years later, he comes back. He sees the girl that he left behind. Or can we say he left her behind? Is it more a case that he left her behind, or she wouldn't go with him? She didn't have the same wanderlust that he had, or ambition, you could look at it that way. And she stayed behind. Okay, we do see her with a guy now that has been a lover for a while, who really is more interested in her, unfortunately, than she is in him. That's pretty much clear. And it's tough. It's a tough role for Aaron Lazar, who's an excellent performer and does everything he can with this role. But it's very hard when you're in a part where you love somebody and you're waiting for the person to turn the switch in herself and come to love you too. And it's just a waiting game, and that's who he has to play. The problem too is that he's on the side of management, and he is telling everybody, look, we're going to give you other jobs. You're not going to get nearly as much money, but you have to take them. They don't want to take them. Well, that's where a priest comes in and says, look, I will fund your building a ship. And that's where they lost me totally, because one of the things that was stated a little later on in the script is that the priest is taking the money from a fund to build a new church. Well, excuse me, why don't these guys build a church? Yes, I know they're shipbuilders. I understand. But, you know, I would think that they'd be able to use the manual labor skills they had and build a church. And I think that would make a much better story, because I don't understand how a priest can justify taking money that parishioners have given for the purpose that they wanted and do something else entirely, where indeed there could be an industrious – look, I understand labors of love. I understand that totally. I understand people loving their jobs and feeling ennobled by them. There's a very famous statement about laborers who were building a cathedral, and somebody said to somebody, what's your job? I just lay the bricks. And what's your job? I'm building a cathedral. You know, and it's the way you look at it. And these guys have pride in what they do, but I bet they'd have equal pride in building a church. And so I think that's where the story went off the rails for me. And I had a tough time with it. A lot of people have been criticizing the dialogue, saying that it's trite. Well, you know, that's the way these people would talk, it seems to me. These are not terribly educated people, so I have no problem with the dialogue as such. It rang true to me as what these people would do. But I'm looking forward to this album. I know there's a concept album out, which I don't have, but I'm looking forward to the original cast album, because the music really is quite wonderful, and I'm so glad my ears won't be jarred by lousy rhymes too often. But this is going to be a hard sell, too. You know, I mean, it's it's a show that it doesn't have much sparkle to it. It doesn't have sizzle, and those shows, those musicals that do that, have a tough time of it. And so I'm not optimistic for the future for this show, but I do think it's a lot of it is quality work. And for the first hour, they had me. After that, they couldn't have got me back no matter what, because the priest has this much money to give them. Where are they getting these supplies? Where are they getting? No, I mean, you know, they don't have anything. They've been locked out. It's not like, well, you know, I mean, you know, a ship, and is this where the whole thing started? A cruise to nowhere? Because they get on the ship, we don't even know where they're going. They don't know where they're going. I mean, it's bizarre. So, so that's a problem with it. But I like the first hour.
All righty. Michael, what'd you think?
Well, yeah, I think the score is wonderful, and the story is quite ridiculous, and it's kind of amazing that the book is credited to John Logan and Brian Yorkey, who John Logan received the Tony Drama Desk Outer Critics Circle and Drama League Awards for Red among his credits. Brian Yorkey got a Pulitzer and a Tony and an Outer Critics Circle Award for Next to Normal. And these two people, between them, to come up with so ridiculous a story, it really the mind boggles. As Peter said, I mean, diverting the money from the building fund is one thing, but then it's, all right, so they're building a ship and they're going to sail off, and what are they going to do? Is it supposed to be income generating in some way? If so, that's completely not made clear. And it's also made clear at several points that none of the men, not one of them, is a sailor, except for Gideon, who at one point decides that maybe he's not going to go anyway. So they're not sailors; they're shipbuilders, and it's two completely different things. And it's just, I don't know what they were thinking. I wonder how much, if any, of the concept was Sting's. I know that two of the songs, I believe, at least, were pre-existing to this project. And I mean, but I don't know how much he information he gave when he went to Logan and or Yorkey. I think my understanding is that Brian Yorkey worked on it first and then was replaced by John Logan.
That's what I've heard.
But I don't. So I don't know what did he say when he went to Brian Yorkey's. You know, did he just say, well, it's a title, The Last Ship, and it's about shipbuilders, and the rest is up to you? Or did he say, well, you know, I want the men to go sailing off on a ship at the end of the show and leave and leave all the women behind and everyone else in the town? I don't know, and I don't know if we ever will. But it's too bad, because God, I thought the score was wonderful. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to get the album, and I thought of you, Peter, as I was listening to it, because I thought, hey, yeah, that rhymes, mm-hmm. that rhymes too.
Yeah, yeah.
It was great, and you know, he's smart in that. The score is very, very hummable and memorable, partly because a lot of phrases are repeated, musical and verbal phrases, but not to excess, just enough to get them really into your ear and say, oh, wow, you know, I was humming several tunes at the intermission and then afterwards. So really, I hope I just wish it's too bad, you know, because so many people – like, you know, pop rock people have tried to write Broadway scores and not done a good job, and I think he really did, and it's just mm-hmm. to be done in by the book is incredibly unfortunate.
We have to give him the benefit of the doubt, but nevertheless, I have a hard time giving him the benefit of the doubt. I would think that he would be the power behind this property. It reminds me of when I was being recruited as one of the possible writers of Cy Fuhr's memoir. They needed a writer. Mm-hmm. And I met with Cy, and I brought my tape recorder, and I transcribed, and I added connective tissue and what have you, and I didn't get the job because, as Cy Fuhr said, you make me sound so much like me. Well, you know, and he wanted something more lofty. Okay. Well, anyway, my point is, you're always, when you do a biography of somebody who's alive, you're always the hired hand, you know, and I'm sure these guys were hired hand because Sting, after all, is Sting, you know, and I could be wrong. And maybe he was very deferential and came with these guys hat in hand and saying, I don't know a thing about Broadway. Help me. It could very well be, you know, and they said, here's our story. And he says, great. You know, we have to allow for that possibility, but don't we all doubt it? I mean, I would think that Sting was saying, no, here's what happens. So that's what I guess.
So I wanted to point out that the three of us have all heard of heard many shows that are in development that haven't made it yet and everything, and it's been my experience, is it your experience, that I see a lot of shows that have very good scores and interesting things happening, and the book is always the problem.
Well, so often, not always, tradition. So often,
yeah.
So my point here is that I really wanted to leave after Act One.
Oh.
I really couldn't stand this show. And but I thought the music was very good, but I thought I was just along the same lines as you, Peter, is that what in the world are they doing?
And, but isn't it incredible with the credits? I mean,
what I'm saying is that if this exact score were written by Michael Portantier, this would have never made it to Broadway.
Well, that's probably quite true. I wish I could write a score like this.
but what I'm saying is that I think that people are cashing in on Sting, and that this work isn't worthy of being on Broadway.
Well, I certainly think that the aggregate of it with the book is not worthy of being on Broadway. I think the score is, but it's kind of hard to separate them.
Yeah, no. I agree with you that the score is great. I'm just saying that this thing that we call theater is about telling the story.
It's very sit-throughable, though. I mean, it's never a case where you're particularly bored or that it's uneven. Joe Mantello was directed as well as he could under the circumstances.
I don't think he did them any favors. There were some like incredible mistakes. Like one thing, I thought maybe it was me, but I swear to God, Rachel Tucker, who plays the leading lady, Meg, looks so much like Sally Ann Triplett, who plays another supporting role, that I got confused. And one is named Meg and the other is named Peg. And they have brown hair, and they both have the same faces. And
Michael, like, I have to agree with you on that. I do. Yeah. I was confused at one point as well. I thought I was seeing the same lady. You know, because when she was talking about married to the old man, you know, I thought, oh, well,
yeah. You know, yes.
And I thought, all right, well, then, you know, she married this guy after she was dumped by Gideon and so on. So, yeah, it took me a while before I put two and two together.
Well, he should know better. And he should also know that he should have known Joe Mantello, I would think. Yes, I'm sure Sting was the engine of the show. But you would think Joe Mantello would have enough power to say, this is not a coherent story, folks. You know, let's fix it. I don't get it.
All righty. So let's move on forward. Michael and Peter got a chance to see Deliverance at 59 East 59. Did it deliver? Peter?
Yes and no. You're in a very tiny space, and that's very good because this is a show that really wants to make you feel trapped as well as the characters are trapped. Here are these butch guys thinking they're going to go on this wonderful time, you know, roughing it in the wilderness, you know, and this show is a terrific advertisement for Club Med. A great, because I'm telling you, you know, you don't go into the woods after you see this show, because they run into some real rednecks. Is really a euphemism for who they run into. Of course, many of us remember what happened to Ned Beatty in the movie. It happens here too, and of course, it's more potent here because it's right in front of you, and I'm talking about a sexual act. And while it's not graphic, like the cabaret I mentioned a few weeks ago. There's a good deal of nudity that might disturb some people, frankly, because it's terrorizing in its own way. Very well done, very well staged. You're in a square. You sit on four sides, one of four sides, and it unfolds in front of you. The famous Deliverance theme is not there. I expected it might be in these eras when we feel, if we don't have the famous song, that there's no sense in even doing the show. We're that mentality seems to be everywhere, but it's not at 59 East 59th. By the way, this is in an upstairs space that is very small. If you've gone to primary stage shows, that's not where you're going to be. Mm-hmm. You're going to be in an upper room upstairs, and I doubt that there are 100 people that can be accommodated. But it's, if you haven't seen the movie, I think you'll enjoy it more because it will be brand new to you. And, of course, the movie is already 42 years old, which, boy, that went fast. And an acceptable evening. Potent, not too long, no intermission, and as it should be. But the real theme of it is the fact that if you get into those woods where you meet essentially people who are animals, you're going to be an animal too. Don't expect that you're going to do the courageous and wonderful thing that that all the lessons you've learned in your life about fair play and all that, that goes by the wayside in 4 seconds. You know, this is a case where it's granted it's self-defense, I'll grant you. Of course it is. But still, you know, maybe there are other solutions that could be you could come to, but you also understand why they come to the conclusions they come to.
I was really looking forward to this very much because it's a production of the Godlight Theater Company, which in the same space upstairs at 59 East 59 a few years ago did a production, an adaptation of George Orwell's 1984 that is really one of the best things I've ever seen. It was so incredibly creative. I did not think this was anywhere near as successful. But I have to say, Peter, most of my problems were with the original story. That I had not, you know, I mean, I had not seen the film since it came out. And God, boy, that's a long time ago, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah.
This, for what it's worth, also is billed as being based on the novel, not on the screenplay. So I don't know. Actually, you know, I did read the novel, but again, yes, so long ago that I don't remember how much different. I think that's there are not major differences between them. One interesting thing is you mentioned they don't have the dueling banjos, but they do have and actually, in this case, it's a banjo and a guitar. So I don't know if that was based on the novel or not, but that was an interesting little difference that it was a banjo and a guitar rather than two banjos, and they did not play that famous theme, which didn't that win an Oscar, or was it just a huge hit, the dueling banjos theme?
It may have won one of those Oscars for scoring, but the song itself didn't win an Oscar.
Oh, okay. All right, but I remember it being getting radio airplay.
Oh, no question. Yeah,
yeah. Just briefly, it's established that these four city guys, they're going to go, you know, down a really rough river on a canoe. Actually, it winds up being two canoes. And it's established that none of them have ever done that before. Then it's one of them at first claims to know the territory, quote unquote. But then when he's pressed about it, he admits that he really doesn't know the territory. They're not sure where the river's going to come out. They're not sure how long it's going to take. They don't know any of this. So it's I couldn't help feeling in watching it again after so long that they really come across as reckless idiots. I wish that had been finessed a little differently in the story, because so I could have had more sympathy for them. I mean, and you know what I mean. They're still, it's still not worth they still don't deserve to be raped and killed, but it just I just thought, what are they doing? You know, I mean, stay home, you know. And as you said, go to Club Med, you know. That was a big problem for me, but it is a very creative company, and the acting was for the most part excellent, and I certainly will go see anything they do in the future, because I do think they have a lot of creativity in them. It's just the source material, frankly, was my problem in this case.
But I guess what's going on here is the fact that there are men who really need to prove themselves as men, as the convention goes.
Absolutely.
And that's why they really believe they can handle anything, because they are men, that is their birthright. And it's far more complicated than that. And you get into trouble really very quickly. In a strange way, it reminded me of Journey's End, because in much of Journey's End, which is a play about World War One, people are just standing around doing nothing for the longest time, and you don't even feel a sense of anything being threatening. And then kaboom, you know, anything can happen at any minute during a war. Well, anything can happen at any minute when you're in the woods with these people around you. So, and these are guys who are just looking, the people they meet in the woods, they're just looking for trouble. That's all it is. Nothing more than that. They want to do evil things, and they need to show that they are the superior beings too. They have those needs, so there's validity here.
Oh well, and one of the men even says as they're on their way to canoeing down the river, one of the locals says something like, you know, what are you going to do that for? And one of them actually says, because it's there. So it is that whole, that's me. I've never been able to comprehend these people who go mountain climbing, who try to scale the, mountains on which hundreds of people have died, over the years. I guess it's noble in a way, but
I guess it depends
what kind of family you have, if you have children, you know, things like that. I mean, I all that factors into it. I think there's personal responsibility too. And
I was on a press trip once where they said, and now we're all going horseback riding. I said, excuse me, Cole Porter was on a horse and it ruined his life. I am not going horseback. So I know what you mean, Michael. All right. Aside from Abraham Lincoln, who's ever been hurt in a theater, you know, so.
And Philip Kasnov.
Yes, I suppose, yeah.
Don't ever get on a stage with me and a sword.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's a
long
story.
You're bad at that, huh?
Yeah. All right, so Peter and Michael got a chance to see the upcoming Broadway revival of Can Can at the Paper Mill Playhouse, where it's, can we call it this, the out-of-town tryout?
Well, that's what they want us to call it. Sure.
All right. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with this?
Although that is absolutely the intention and has been stated many, many times, I don't think you're going to see this on Broadway. I think that the rewritten version of the show, which is credited to, it says music and lyrics by Cole Porter, book by Abe Burrows, revised by Joel Fields and David Lee. And David Lee, I don't know very little about Joel Fields. David Lee is famous as the creator of, or our creator of, the TV series Frasier and Wings, both of which I absolutely loved. But I don't know. I mean, the huge problem here is that I don't think it's funny. I don't think the rewritten book is funny. I remember lines from the original version, which I saw. Well, I saw it actually twice. I saw it in 1977 at Wagner College on Staten Island. Had a summer theater for 1 year, and they did three Cole Porter shows, and this was one of them. And then I saw it at Encores, but I'm told I know there were cuts to the book, but I'm told that there were rewrites for that one as well. Do you know, Peter?
No, I didn't see it. I had to be out of town.
Well, that was really pretty great. Patti LuPone was superb, I thought.
I'm sure.
Yeah. It was really well done. But this one, it's I mean, I love Kate Baldwin. She sounds phenomenal in this show. She looks like $10 million. So beautiful. I don't think she has an ounce of Gallic flavor to her at all. And I'm not even saying that I think that the character needs to have a French accent, which when you think about it, doesn't make any sense unless everyone does. So it's not that so much, but it's just, I don't know, there's something so American or so Irish. And also she comes across as a friend of mine used the word patrician. I'm not sure if that's a pretty good word. So she doesn't really have an edge to her. She seems very upper class. And I did not think she was good casting at all as Pistache. The choreography is excellent by Patti Colombo. Let me say that before I go any further. This was unfortunately the show looks great as far as costumes and pretty good as far as sets. This is the only paper mill show I have ever seen where I felt the orchestra was wanting. Very, very scrawny. It's on stage on a raised platform that might have something to do with it. But I was also told, and this is just hearsay, but that not all the money that they were originally counting on came through and they had to cut back in some areas, which makes sense to me because really I can't. Did you ever see another paper mill show where the orchestra was wanting? I cannot remember that happening.
Not this type of musical. No, they certainly have had shows where, for example, the other Josh Cohen, you know, I mean, which is not that type of show at all.
Yeah.
But in terms of a conventional Broadway musical, a classic Broadway musical, yes, you're quite right.
Right. Michael Burress was excellent in the show also, and Greg Hildreth. But I just did not like the rewrites. The original, let me say, and structurally, that I think overall structure, that it was an improvement. There's some very weird things about the original version, including the fact that it opens in the court room after the girls have they've been, you know, hauled into court, and that's the very first thing we see, but we don't see why they've been hauled into court, so that's a little weird. And then in the original, the can-can does not happen until the very end, very, very end of the show, which that in itself is not so weird. But again, it happens in the courtroom. Whereas here, you know, at least it happens earlier on and it's done in the nightclub. So that made sense to me structurally. But Abe Burrows co-wrote Guys and Dolls and apparently wrote most of or all of anything in it that's funny, which is, you know, most of it or all of it. So I don't think that the jokes needed to be rewritten. I mean, I hardly laughed once during the show, and I think that's a huge problem for a musical comedy like this.
So, Peter, what'd you think?
Well, the story is a bit improved from the vantage point of a backstory. Originally, this was a story about Pistache, who runs this nightclub where they do the can-can, which is considered a vulgar and filthy dance. And as a result, they do get hauled into court, as Michael said, and the judge there certainly has feelings that the law should be upheld. And it's one of those stories where by the end of the show, of course, he comes around and realizes, you know, oh, really, what's the harm? Well, what happens here is, and I think it's a smart move, is that once upon a time, Pistache and Aristide, the judge, were lovers. And issues like this set them apart. And they haven't seen each other for a long, long time now. And he didn't even know she was doing this. But he heard that this was happening at the club, and he went to investigate. There's very interesting things about that, too, when you think about it. He went to investigate. You know, I guess that steps out of the fact that he's eventually going to approve of the can-can. But the problem is, once that's set up, you're just marking time until finally, you know, he says, okay, I give in. And there are plenty of irrelevant songs and dances. They're very nice songs. They're very nice dances. Yes. But if we're going to talk about, we were talking earlier about how the book is the problem so many times. Well, the problem's here because you just feel that it is, the problem is solved at the 2:15 mark when they say, well, that's a good length for a show to be. And let's wrap it up. It could have been wrapped up at the end of the first act. And that's, by the way, you know, though Can-Can sounds like a classic title. The fact is this show opened to pretty rotten reviews when it opened. In fact, even the score got lousy reviews, which is kind of interesting because at least four hits and arguably five came out of it that really did dominate the charts back in 1953 when it originally opened. But nobody respected this work way back then. The movie gets a lot of heat for being lousy, but frankly, I don't think it's any worse than the show. I really don't. I mean, it's different, and the decisions are made that I thought were, you know, pretty decent in the movie. But it's neither. It's really not an abomination compared to the original. It's a sincere attempt to make something that didn't work terribly well better. It doesn't succeed. Don't misunderstand me. But nevertheless, I don't think the gulf is as wide as many people have said it is between the stage show of Can-Can and the movie.
Well, they also, I mean, they kind of gave up, if that's the right word, and just made it like a Las Vegas musical. But I know Gerard Alessandrini, for one, feels that was exactly the right thing to do. So I see what you're saying.
Well, the other thing, too, by the way, about Kate Baldwin, one of my feelings was that, oh, she's much too young. I mean, Pistachio. But I was going to make this point, and I was going to prove my point by saying, now look at the original woman who did it, Lilo. That was her name, one word, Lilo.
Oh, I know.
She was 28.
I know. Isn't that
28? I mean, she's running a nightclub. I mean, really, so I can't pin anything on Kate Baldwin and being too young. Who's, I dare say Kate's over 28. And Kate, if you're not, forgive me. But I was very surprised. I did the math like three or four times. I said, this can't be right. You know, I mean, but it was. So there you are.
And in fact, she's been around. She
showed up, right.
Yeah, so I saw a photo of her in the original show and recently, and I had no idea what a, you know, young bombshell she was.
However, if you got the souvenir booklet to Pousse Café, a musical she did in 1966, which lasted three performances, you would say it was a terrible touch-up job. I mean, the pictures, you can tell they've been doctored. It's so hilarious. I don't know how the hell they got out, but it's the most embarrassing picture you have ever seen in a souvenir booklet because it is so clearly doctored. Really see the outline of every little mark that they made. So, you know, I got the that souvenir book long after the fact. It was sent to me by the man who did souvenir booklets, a guy named Cal Efron, and I have a feeling he just sent it to me that this was one that they'd never used, you know. And of course, mm-hmm. It could be effectively argued they had plenty left over, given the show ran three performances, you know. So, Pousse Café. It was a musical of the Blue Angel, and Stanley Kaufman's lead was great. What's new, Pousse Café?
Well, maybe I can leave you with this because this is really kind of this just really was so wonderful for me. Speaking of souvenir programs, a friend of mine has he somehow acquired a copy of the original Can-Can souvenir program, and the program itself is great to look through, and that's where I saw that picture of Lilo that I was referring to. But also there's a ticket order form inside of the program, and what apparently happened was this fellow had ordered tickets for a certain day and sent in the form, and they couldn't fill it, so they mailed it back to him, and it said, "The cops are coming for me now."
coming to take me away, right? Yeah.
But the guy filled out his name, and he wanted one orchestra ticket for I think it was a Thursday or night for $7.20.
Yep.
And the box office fellow hand wrote on the order form, sorry, sold out for that date. Suggest you try at the box office for cancellations. And it says Sam S. Schubert Theater, and it has the address, and it has, you know, the little the printing, and then the lines where you fill in your name and the price you want. wanted and the date. And it's just a little time capsule to think that that's how people used to order tickets.
Oh, did they ever? You bet. Oh my God. Mail orders. We all had to do that. You know, and by the way, when I ordered mail orders in Boston for the tryouts, I used to say, I don't care what date you give me, but I must be in the first 10 rows of the orchestra or send me back my money. And when Do I Hear a Waltz did, oh my God, I was apoplectic. I was going to throw myself in the Charles River. You know, the new Richard Rodgers music with Stephen Sondheim. Are you kidding me? You know, I was at the box office the day it opened, and thank God I got a seat. But, I mean, that was touch and go for a while.
Well, you know, some of the newer listeners may not remember when the fall or spring theater preview in the New York Times on Sunday would come out with full-page ads, and we'd plan our seasons based upon these ads. That I don't even know if exist anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Yep. All right. So before we wrap up, I wanted to mention that earlier in our discussion about On the Town, Peter talked about revivals not running quite as long as the originals. And we came across the news this afternoon that Pippin is taking its last bow on the 4th. Of January.
Yeah, that ominous date.
That
you know,
day.
Really, yeah. This one will have run a little bit longer than the third of the originals. So, but ironically enough, I saw it last week. I wanted to buy a present for a dear, dear friend, and that's what he wanted to see. So I went with him, and it's in very nice shape.
Well, you must have seen Kyle Dean Massey and not this new. This TV guy that they TV.
Right. Yeah. I saw Kyle Dean Massey and Lucy Arnaz before they took off.
Yeah.
Lucy Arnaz is much. While I will admit, and forgive me, Lucy, that she's not that far from the 66 years that the character says she is. Lucy Arnaz does not remotely look as if she's that old. And even though they put a little gray in her hair, she has to have her comparative youth, her consolation that she looks so good that she was really in essence miscast. But boy, she did everything that was asked of her. I'll tell you, I mean, that means that trapeze stuff too, you know, so it's in good shape. I mean, again, who knows the new guy, you know, and yes, and I can't say for sure, but the rest of the company was pretty good. And I don't think you're going to be shortchanged if you haven't seen Pippin, that I can recommend that you go.
Yes.
And speaking of Pippin, Patina Miller, who made her bones in Pippin, is now on a television series on CBS called Madam Secretary, packed full of Broadway folks, with like B.B. Newirth and who else was in it that I recognized? Oh, Eric Bergen.
Good.
A few other folks here and there. So I'm not sure if they're shooting in New York, but there seems to be a lot of Broadway folks in it. So if you get a chance, jump over to CBS and check out Madam Secretary.
Has either of you seen Birdman?
No, I was just going to bring that up. Very much about the theater, but apparently also, again, it's not going to go over well with people who know like the facts about the way things actually happen.
I see. So it has the smash syndrome.
Yes.
All right, so let's wrap it up. I'd like to remind listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many other ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and you can get streamed directly to you. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m. and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found on BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about this evening. So on behalf of Michael Portantiere and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
One more day on my own.
Will we ever meet again?
One more day with him that
and I swear I will be true.
But he never saw me there.
of freedom.
Shall I join my brothers there?
When our ranks begin to fall.
Boys, they will wet themselves with blood.
Watch your hand and laugh, catch them as they fall. Never know your luck when there's a brave marvel. Here a little dip, there a little touch. Most of them are gone, so they won't miss much.
Won't it do what you
raise the flag of freedom high.
Judgment day
tomorrow.